On the show today, we have the Sheeter Group's very own Andy Sheeter and Tarjaman Relief's Gonzalo LaSalle and Will Felder. And this is an episode you gotta watch because these guys are helping Afghan interpreters literally escape Afghanistan and funding them until they get a firm financial footing in another country, whether it's a neighboring country to Afghanistan or here in the U.S. These guys are doing extraordinary work, and we would love it if credit unions got involved, because this is right in the credit union wheelhouse of people helping people. And so we have Andy and Gonzo and Will on the show giving us all of what they do. It's, again, just extraordinary work in helping these people that actually helped them when they were over there serving our country. So again, be sure to watch this episode and do what you can to help out. We have links in the show notes to contact these folks and do your part to help out. Just, again, extraordinary work. So enjoy the episode. Hey everybody, Mike Lawson here with CU Broadcast. Hey, do we have an episode for you all today? And oh my gosh, it just gives me goosebumps thinking about the conversation that's about to happen. But first, we have to do introductions, and I'm going to introduce you to three fine gentlemen doing some fantastic work on a global level. But first, hey, I'm going to start right below me, Mr. Andy Sheeter from the Sheeter Group. Andy, how are you, sir?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us. And he's the instigator of all this. So thanks for bringing this to my attention. So, all right. And I'm going to introduce these two fine gentlemen. They are part of the Tarjaman Relief, and they are doing some great work in Afghanistan. And right kind of diagonal down below me is Gonzalo LaSalle, or Gonzo LaSalle, however you want to go, Gonzalo. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us. I really appreciate you putting this together. And Gonzalo or Gonzo, you can call me Gonzo. It's a lot easier.
Thank you. Sounds good. And then right next to me is Will Felder, also from Tarjaman Relief. Will, how are you, sir? Welcome.
Very well. Thanks for having us. This is great.
Yeah. Oh, can't wait. All right. So kind of in a nutshell, and I know you guys can probably explain it a lot better than me, but I'm just kind of do a quick little summary here. But you guys are basically helping Afghan interpreters escape Afghanistan or get out of Afghanistan, and kind of funding them just to help them get on a firm financial footing as they're like living in another country, whether it's a neighboring country of Afghanistan or here in the U.S. So is that kind of pretty much it in a nutshell, Will?
Yeah, that's right. Look, with the capitulation of the Afghan government earlier this year, there have been hundreds of people, thousands of people who have been displaced from their normal walk of life. And the people who were most at risk were those who ostensibly or very, very, very overtly supported the U.S. government in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And as a result, a swelling of grassroots movements sprung up, a lot of veteran organizations that wanted to pitch in and help, because a lot of us, you know, standing on the sidelines were saying, you know, this is horrible and we just want to help. So we're just one of those small groups that started up. A group of us got together, started 501c3, started seeing how we could pitch in and help out. And in the early days, that was a lot of the stuff that's been written about in the New York Times and the mainstream media about what happened as the airport in Kabul closed. But the problem didn't stop then. And so what our group has been focused on is the legal movement of Afghans who supported the U.S. government from Afghanistan to other countries, to include the U.S. And this is now a long-term problem that we're trying to do our part to make sure that those who supported us in Afghanistan are safe and have the ability to live the life that we promised them, a life of opportunity for them and their children.
Yeah. And before we get too deep into that, I want to get your background real quick, Will, and Gonzo will get to your background as well. So you and Gonzo served in Afghanistan together in the mid-2000s. So can you give us just a real brief background there and then, you know, talk about your tour in Afghanistan just super briefly?
No, absolutely. I mean, look, I graduated from West Point and became a young infantry officer, showed up at the 10th Mountain Division in Fort Drum, New York, and waiting for me was Sergeant First Class Gonzalo LaSalle, my soon-to-be platoon. And, you know, we sort of took it from there and ended up spending the better part of 2 years pretty much living together, doing everything together, becoming a team. And they always joke that in the Army, the relationship between your platoon leader and a platoon sergeant is like a marriage. And so when I ended up getting promoted to captain, you know, these other lieutenants brought their wives. I was unmarried at the time, so I brought Sergeant First Sally as my spouse to promote me to captain. So, you know, we formed a very incredibly tight friendship. And part of that was spending 17 months in Afghanistan together. And at a time, you know, 2006, 2007, when it was a very dangerous time to be there. And there was certainly a lot of that going on. But it was also a time of a lot of hope. There's still a lot of hope that what we were doing could result in sea change for the people of Afghanistan. And we formed incredibly close friendships with the people that we worked with. Both of us shared a background where we celebrated international culture, international cuisine. And so we sort of jumped right in and tried to become a part of the communities that we were trying to support from a military standpoint, but also try to just get involved as much as we could. And it was life-changing for both of us. I mean, both of us walked away from Afghanistan feeling a deep sense of love for the country and for the people there.
Yeah. So, yeah. As most did, you know, serving our country there for sure. And you guys are just two great examples of your service, helping the Afghan folks and protecting our country as well. So we deep, deep gratitude for that just off the bat here. So, and I want to stick with you, Will, on this one. So how did the Afghans, how did they help you guys, the military that is, during your time there? And then the second part of that question is like, what kind of risk did this help put them in as well?
Yeah, we employed probably at any given point in time, 10 to 12 local national interpreters in our formation. And the services that they provided were not just translating the words we spoke, but providing us a linkage and a window into the cultural traditions of the people that we were working with. They would set up meetings. They would help us map out who was important in a certain village. They'd give us advice as to customs and traditions that we should follow and use as part of our ability to build ties with the communities that we were working in. And on the point of risk, they did everything we did. They rode in the same vehicles we rode in. When we were engaged in a firefight, they were right by our side. In fact, you know, as a platoon leader, I had a guy who carried my radios. And so I, you know, that's, you know, if I needed to talk to someone who was an American, I'd grab my RTO and he would hand me the right radio and I would talk to who I needed to talk to. Exactly this in the same manner, when we were working with an Afghan army unit, one of my interpreters was carrying a radio, standing right by my side, so that if I needed to talk to the commander of that Afghan army element, you know, I couldn't get on the radio and talk to him as efficiently as if I told my interpreter, hey, you know, you call Captain so-and-so and tell him he needs to move further left or whatever. So, you know, they integrated with our units as if they were just another member of the team, and lived the way we live, fought alongside of us. And there are, you know, many cases where exposed themselves to even greater risks because they were the ones who would leave and go talk to a local national about, you know, any issue that had come up. You know, you killed the wrong goat, and the interpreter would go off and negotiate whatever the appropriate payment was. So, you know, they're an integral part of the team and put themselves at the same risk that we were in.
Yeah, and even afterwards, I mean, now that the Taliban has come in, and you know, their lives are even more at stake as well. So yeah, so the protection is vital.
That's an outstanding point. And it's even before this, you know, there were interpreters who would go off on a couple week vacation and never come back because they were caught while they were traveling home for vacation. They put themselves at an incredible level of risk, not just with us, but once we were gone or once, you know, I was 40 years old, decided to hang up the cleats and not be an interpreter anymore and move back home. he was at risk because of his overt support for U.S. forces.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's just an amazing situation over there. So Gonzo, I'm coming to you on this one. So what are you all trying to do today to help bring many of these folks back to the U.S. and out of harm's way? What are you guys doing here? I'm sure our viewers are dying to know here.
Yeah, I think it's important to have an understanding of how it started as well.
Yeah.
You know, before we evacuated the airport, everybody was trying to get into that airport. And there were small cells of veterans whose interpreters had just reached out to all of them saying, please help me. Is there anything you can do? I'm a 21-year Army retiree, retired as a sergeant major. I no longer do that anymore. So when they started calling me based off the letters of recommendation that I had written for them, luckily I still had the same phone numbers back then, asking me to help them. You know, their lives was in danger. You know, all I could do is I felt morally obligated to do everything that I could do. And this started off as, you know, six people in my dining room, treating it as a tactical operations center with big screen TVs on the walls with overlays and graphics showing where Taliban checkpoints were and all of us trying to move them from safe house to safe house, you know, while the Taliban was going from door to door looking for them. At the same time, Will and John, two of our directors, were starting up the 501c3, and we kind of just joined at one point and said, we just need to continue to support each other with this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what that turned into is the media stopped reporting, you know, August 31st. And we continued to fight and move these, you know, these partners of us around from safe house to safe house until, you know, we finally started realizing that the resource that was the most fruitful to us was the same resource that we were hiding. These interpreters, we were hiding them in safe houses, and they're exactly what we needed on the ground to be able to accomplish what we're doing. When we first started trying to move people across the border, somebody was trying to, you know, charge us in a ridiculous amount for the resources. And it wasn't until we started providing the interpreters with the resources that we have that we started to realize that they are our best resource. We started to get them across the border. We've established logistics cells in Pakistan. These same interpreters that we were hiding in apartments are the same interpreters that are now running logistics for us. What does that mean? Ensuring that the safe houses are getting food, ensuring that people are getting medical attention that they need, providing safe passage within Afghanistan and across the borders. These interpreters no longer have jobs. They no longer have homes. Their families are on the run. They're being actively hunted like animals by the Taliban. So all we can do is try to provide them as much as we can with safe passage, safe homes, and the ability to you know, come across a different border lawfully as best as we can. The limiting factor to all of this is money, of course. And that's how I reached out to the Sheeter Group. I remember Andy was asking me back in May when I was telling him about my troubles with getting one of my interpreters a special immigration visa and the bureaucracy that we were going through. And he told me then, he's like, well, if you ever need my help with anything, whatever that is, just let me know. And it just turned out that I needed his help monetarily come August to help get some families across the border. And I think at the time we were trying to get one family across the border, and I think the cost was going to be like $75,000 to get one family across the border. And it, you know, Will and I took a step back and we're like, why? We've both been to Afghanistan. Why would it cost so much? And it wasn't until, like I said, that we started taking all the other people out of the equation and supporting the people on the ground, the Afghans, that we started to learn that it doesn't cost that much to support the Afghans to cross the border, have an apartment in a different country, be able to continue their application processes in different countries. And this is what it's all merged into, you know, went from the tactical fight to the strategic fight.
Yeah.
And now we're trying to support them, sustain them until we can get them lawfully into the United States through some sort of legislatively approved visa program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mission has changed a little bit for you guys. So, yeah, so you're going to really help these people out who helped you out during your time there. So, Andy, I'm going to come to you and say, what is your role in all of this besides, again, being the instigator here and helping getting the word out of this tremendous cause that these guys are working on?
Yeah, so I'm president and founder of the Cedar Group, and we work exclusively with credit unions. And we have the same philosophy that credit unions have, and that is people helping people. And that's why early on I offered my assistance to Gonzalo if he needed anything. And I remember the phone call I got from him in August. I think it was a weekend, and I was at home, and I received a call, and he said, I need $75,000 to get a family out. And I saw a video of the family pleading for help. And two things went through my mind. The first was $75,000 is a lot of money.
Yeah.
The second thing was, you know, what's the value of a family's life? Which is a pretty heavy thought that I'm not used to having to think about. And after the second thought, it was pretty obvious what needed to happen. So I was able to gather the troops with the Cedar Group, my colleagues, and we all band together and were able to raise a substantial amount of money that we sent to help Gonzo and Will's program and really stepped up to the plate. And the great thing about what they did, as Gonzalo just alluded to, is the way they use the money, because what we gave just didn't get one family out. It got a lot more than that.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. You use that. So Gonzo, yeah, talk about how you guys were able to help, how you guys have been able to help so far in coordinating with the Cedar Group. And so how did that process work?
Absolutely. So like we talked about, you know, we started off thinking we needed $75,000 to move one family across, and that $75,000, we've been able to continue to stretch that and use a methodical approach. We've gotten, I venture to say, over 170 people out with the amount of money that we were able to be provided by the Cedar Group.
Well done.
That's just out of the country. There's some that are already in the United States legally. There's over 300 that we're moving from safe house to safe house still within Afghanistan. We have 1,800 plus people that have now joined our list. It started off with a list of 31, and it's now 1,800 people. We've absorbed some of the organizations that were working alongside of us into our organization because we were organized, and they like our methodical approach to be able to accomplish this. What have we done? We've delivered two babies. Where there was a woman that was going in labor as she was crossing the border, got her to a hospital, paid her hospital bills. She's now living in an apartment with her husband and her newborn baby. And they're safe. They're not being hunted by the Taliban anymore. Oh. They were in biometric systems that the Taliban is able to utilize to identify these people. So what else? The family that was pleading for help, back in August that we were sending to all the congressmen. I have videos of them, in a safe house right now, and they're very appreciative. They're working with us now. They're actually the resources that we're utilizing to help the rest of the Afghans, and they're happy to do that.
Oh, that's such an amazing, amazing story. Now, Will, what makes your organization different from others out there? Because you mentioned at the top that there was a lot of these grassroots organizations popping up everywhere and doing some great work, of course. So what makes your organization different? And then what's the ultimate goal here that you guys want to achieve?
Yeah, I think the we alluded to one point that makes our organization different, which is that we take a methodical, very deliberate approach to how we help. And look, when I left active duty, I got a JD MBA, then I became an investment banker. And I think about things in terms of return on investment. And because I have a JD, I think about what's legal. And so when I looked at this problem, and as Gonzo described, we looked at the costs that people were asking to do something that we thought could be done a lot more efficiently. And so that's what we set off to do. And it was really hard at that time to look at a video like we alluded to and to say, we're going to pause and think and be methodical and try to do this the best way possible. But because we were able to take that methodical approach, we've been able to use our resources to help so many more people. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to continue to do. The second point is that we do it all legally. You know, we are not trying to bring people to the United States illegally. We're not trying to smuggle them across a border. We are trying to do everything so that we put the people that we're trying to help in the best possible position for their long-term ability to live their lives well. It does no one any good to sneak someone in somewhere where they're not supposed to be, because they could find themselves in a lot more trouble than they're in right now.
Yeah.
And then the final point I'll make is that we don't try to step on anyone's toes. There's a lot of great stuff going on right now. So for example, welcome.us is the official resettlement program run as a public-private partnership, and they're doing incredible work for people who are in the U.S. No One Left Behind is an outstanding organization that's resettling people in the U.S. We have coordinated all of our people with those organizations so that the minute our people are in the U.S. and they can take advantage of some of the great stuff that other organizations are doing, we're happy to send them on their way and receive help through people who are doing that kind of great work. So we're really trying to maintain a laser focus on what it is that we do really well, which is to legally and efficiently keep people safe in Afghanistan and move them to a place where they can await adjudication through the normal visa process.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all we do. But to do that, for the number of people that we have on our list, would require millions of dollars. For each person on our list, it costs us about $1,000 to facilitate all the, transportation, logistics, et cetera, to get someone from Kabul to Islamabad. It costs us $500 to $1,000 a month, depending on the size of the family, to house someone in a place like Islamabad or elsewhere in Pakistan. And so for the 1,800 people that we're currently tracking, and there's no indication to us that that list is going to get any smaller.
You're right about that.
The math is very simple. And right now, because we're slow and methodical and deliberate, what we've done is we've put a pause on our operations because our intent is to support the people that we have put in the position that we put them in. So if we've moved someone to Pakistan, it is our moral obligation to plan for their support for as long as it takes to adjudicate their visa claim or their asylum claim. Mm-hmm. We're not going to move someone until we can make that commitment. And where we are with our current fundraising is that the people that we have moved, we have enough money to sustain them for the time that we think it's going to take for them to go through the official immigration process. Mm-hmm. And so we will not move anyone else until we've raised the money.
Okay. Good
move. to make that same commitment to those people before we move them.
And how long is that process? Because we had a call and we had a kind of a pre-interview call, and you guys are talking about how long that process is. Is it like 2 years, 3 years or something? I mean, I'm sure it vacillates or,
So on average, it's taken people 2 to 3 years to have their SIV, in the case of an SIV, to have that process. There are also two new categories of asylum claims that the U.S. government has approved for people who work for U.S. government forces in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And those categories of asylum haven't even been administratively organized as to how they're going to get processed, how they're going to get approved. USCIS is so overwhelmed with humanitarian parole applications at the southern border and because of what's happened in Afghanistan, that not a single humanitarian parole claim that was filed from Afghanistan since August 31st has been approved. And the humanitarian parole process is the process for sort of a short-term allowance to come to the U.S. Mm-hmm. So the inner workings of our immigration system are so clogged right now that our planning is basically for 3 years.
That's a long time. And that's what these funds are for, to help these people during that kind of in between time, stay financially on their feet and perhaps get a job somewhere in the meantime, and then come out of this, looking pretty good.
You make a good point there too, which is the problem with being a refugee and the problem with having asylum status in most countries is that you're not authorized to work in that country.
Oh my gosh.
While you're seeking asylum, your legal status in that country is just to be safe, but it's not to have a job. It's not to have a driver's license. It's not to take advantage of anything else in that country except just safety. So,
oh my goodness. Wow. Well, that even emphasizes the work that you guys are doing. Good grief. Now, Andy, how can credit unions come in, step up and help, because this is in their wheelhouse. Obviously, the mission here is people helping people, and this is right in their wheelhouse on a global level. So it sounds like, you know, finances is one of the keys to succeeding here and helping these people out. So where can folks go? What can folks do to help out? Can you share?
Yes. Yeah. Folks can start. They can reach out to me, Andy Sheeter, with the Sheeter Group. You can go to the Sheeter Group website. There's a contact us form there. You can also send me an email at asheeter@sheeterconsulting.com.
Okay.
And start the process there, and then I can get you in touch with appropriate people at Targimon. And then, you know, the big area of need is going to be the financial assistance, certainly, but there may be other things that a credit union may be able to offer as well, you know, in terms of administrative help. So I'm sure we're open to anything.
Okay. And Gonzo, yeah, is the Targimon Relief, do you guys have a website? And if so, what's the website and where can folks go check that out?
Yeah, absolutely. It's targimon.org, targimon.org.
Okay. Okay, great. Yeah, we will put that link in the show notes as well as your contact information, Andy, so people can get right to it. Gentlemen, this has been quite, I mean, I wish we had more time to talk about this. Oh my gosh, I want to go on for another hour at least. But Will, I'm going to start with you. Is there anything else to add? Any final thoughts here? I think this sounds like, I'd say final thoughts, but this is something that's just getting going for you guys here. So any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I just think, you know, this is there's so many people in this country and also in the world who face tough times, and that's just an unfortunate reality. And you know, there are lots of people helping people, but in this particular instance, these people that we're helping, the reason that they need our help is because our country has put them in the situation that they're in. They helped our country. And for better or for worse, we made the decision that we were not going to be involved in Afghanistan militarily anymore. And that decision caused the circumstance that these people are in.
Yeah, you're right.
And so we have a moral obligation to help this class of people because of the position we've put them in.
So true. So true. Gonzo, any final words?
No, I think it's important to know that they weren't just interpreters. They were right next to us during firefights. Some of the interpreters that we're helping right now that you know, we've helped get to Pakistan, they were plugging bullet holes in Americans with their fingers. Oh. They were pulling them away from firefights, bringing them into, you know, our ambulatory helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
They put themselves out there with us, and then we just can't leave them behind.
I agree. Yeah, somebody said the term partner during the interview. That's a really good one, but it sounds like more like family almost. So yeah, to just become a part of your family. Andy, final thoughts here, final words? This is, you started this whole thing.
Yeah,
well, let's keep it going.
You know, I echo Will's sentiment. You know, the thing that's always in the back of my mind is that, you know, the U.S., we made promises to these people. And unfortunately, you know, the people that made the promises didn't step up and, you know, fulfill their promise. So it's up to us, but there's nothing we can do about that now.
Right.
It's water under the bridge. So, you know, it's certainly a silver lining to be able to step up in, not only from a humanitarian point of view, but also from a patriotic point of view and, you know, and help keep, you know, the hopefully good image that we'd like to have as, you know, United States of America around the world.
Yeah. And just plain and simple, it's the right thing to do. You know, it's just the right thing to do. All right, gentlemen. Well, I'm going to let you get back to your work and your lives. And but this is, I hope we create a groundswell for you here, because this is something, again, it's the right thing to do. So appreciate your time. And again, we'll put all the links and stuff in the show notes so people can get right to it and get you all the resources that you need to keep your work and keep this going even more so. So again, thank you so much for your service. And again, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are welcome.